you should always be pitching. The coffee shop person, pitch to them. The investor, pitch to them. Your parents, your friends, your loved ones, pitch to them. Always be pitching. Some of the worst fears entrepreneurs have is that they're not ready to talk about their idea, or they think that person might steal it or whatever. It's the number of situations where something's got stolen just by you talking about it is incredibly low. And research also points to that, which is, you know, this is advice everybody should take to heart. ABP, I say, always be pitching.
Welcome to Babson Built, where we interview Babson founders and entrepreneurs, people who have tried, failed, and tried again.
They're the change makers, the disruptors, the hustlers, and the builders. These are their stories.
Today on Babson Built, we have Rich Palmer. Rich is the co-founder and CTO at Gravity, the first AI company focused solely on the social good industry. The company uses AI and machine learning to help nonprofits reach their fundraising goals. He graduated from Babson in 2016. In October 2019, Rich was honored at Boston Business Journal's 40 Under 40 event, and the company recently raised $21 million. So we have lots to talk about on today's episode with Rich. Welcome to Babson Built, Rich. I'm Vaidehi Tembaker, and I'm super excited to have you here.
Awesome. I'm very excited to be here as well.
Great. So let's start with your journey at Babson. You completed your MBA and graduated in 2016. Can you tell us a little bit about what made you want to do an MBA, and in particular, why Babson?
Yep. So I love the origin story. So here's my origin story, right? So actually started my career on Wall Street. So I got a degree in information technology and economics from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute up in Troy, New York. And where do you go with that? Down to finance. And, you know, day two of that experience, they actually put me in charge of the portfolio analytics team, which was really helping fund managers take advantage of data. So try to figure out which stocks they should buy or sell, which sectors they should over or underweight. And that'll come important later on. About 4 years into there, I started reading articles from Paul Graham, who's the founder of Y Combinator. I got my hands on Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek. And the combination of all of those things led me to actually quit Wall Street, sell all my stuff. So I had about 100 items left, and I moved cross-country to Berkeley, California to actually start my first company. It was an abysmal failure. So I brought one of my, you know, technically minded friends at the time. We spent about 3 months, 4 months coding away in our little apartment, not talking to customers. And so the first day we got in front of the customers, they asked us some serious questions about who's liable for this, who pays for what, how do all these things happen? And we, from my perspective, I learned quickly there was a whole bunch I didn't know about the entrepreneurial experience, which actually brought me back to New York City, to Wall Street. The former founder of the company I was working at started a company called Relationship Science, which their goal was really to organize information about people so we could figure out paths between folks. So if I was trying to get to, you know, Steve Spinelli at Babson, I just knew you. What is the path from me to you, you to him, so we can get stuff done in the world? So we raised about $120 million there, which was an awesome experience. Very entrepreneurial, but they also struggled in their own way. So they had a very broad vision. So this sort of lack of clear focus and vision meant we went in a bunch of different directions. And the abundance of capital meant we pursued all of those directions, which was harmful. Right. About 2.5 years into RelSci, I actually suffered from a brain aneurysm rupture, which if you or the listeners know about it, super serious. About half the people die on the spot. The other folks are left with really difficult issues they have to overcome for the rest of their lives. For me, I'm one of the more lucky folks, and it forced me to sort of take all of my past experiences, the failures and the learnings, and combine that all together to say, I know tech. I've learned how to run big teams and big companies, but I want to do something better with my second chance. And that actually is what brought me to Babson. So number one in entrepreneurship, I knew a couple of the professors there. It was a brand new network. And you know, in hindsight, I wouldn't have changed a single thing because of where we ended up. So excited about this journey.
That's such an interesting story. And you mentioned all your entrepreneurial experiences. So I just wanted to ask, did you always from a very young age know you wanted to become an entrepreneur, or was there something in particular that inspired you on the way?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I've learned to be a fixer because when I was growing up, I was more of a breaker. And the good story there is my dad was actually really lucky to get involved in technology real early, and was actually doing like punch card stuff for maybe it's AT&T or something similar, right? And so as he continued to do some like database work, he would bring home old equipment from all of these different places. He was a consultant, so he had worked a lot of different places throughout his career. And I was always allowed to do whatever I wanted with that, you know, mix match hard drives, you know, try to fix a monitor or whatever. One day he brought home what I thought was fair game, one of those like CD writers, which now it's like not even a thing, but at the time it was blazing fast at 1x speed. So basically if you needed 60 minutes or whatever to write the CD, it would take 60 minutes to write the CD. And I took it apart. And this thing costs, I don't even know if I am allowed to know how much it costs. And it all of a sudden sort of put two things in perspective. One, you know, my dad saying, cool, dude, you need your own stuff and your own space. But B, it wasn't just enough to break stuff. You had to fix it if you broke it or try new things or put things together. So I think I wanted to go to school for networking. So laying networking cables and switches and routers and stuff. Quickly realized I didn't want to crawl around, you know, spider web crawl spaces. So got over to economics, got over to proper computer science, and that sort of break stuff, move fast to make it better, I think was entrepreneurial roots in the making.
That's great. That's great. And so let's just move on a little in your journey. So you are also an adjunct professor at Babson. Can you tell us how that opportunity came about and why you were interested in something like that?
Yeah, so it's funny enough at my company now, they call me Professor Rich because I tend to sort of gravitate towards those teaching moments. I'm always of the mindset that, you know, if you want my help, one of the things I can tell you what I think, or I can show you how to think. And that difference between telling and showing, it's sort of that Socratic method of teaching and helping self-discovery of problems. It just appeals to me incredibly, I think, at my core, right? And so I had been doing some independent studies with Andrew Corbett, who's the faculty chair of the Blank Center, which is, you know, at Babson, and really saying, hey, man, I think we could do something a little different here, or I think we could do that, or what if I try this? And one of my independent studies is actually rooted in my aneurysm experience, which is how do you stay calm and mindful while also going through entrepreneurship, the most challenging thing really most people choose to do, right, in the business sense. And so we sort of got to talking, and I think it was maybe 6 months, if not max a year after I graduated, P asked me to help him reimagine the new venture creation course there. And I had been sort of guest lecturing on AI and entrepreneurship and all that kind of stuff, and jumped at that opportunity incredibly. And learned a couple of things, if I might go on this, right? So one, people never, ever, ever talk about their fears with entrepreneurship. And at Babson, we're incredibly privileged, right? Top one, you know, number one forever. You get to Babson because you have some privilege often. You know, we're working on problems and stuff, but nobody ever talks about the opposite side, the fears that they're trying to overcome. And so we actually walked through one example, which might seem like it belongs in a fourth grade classroom, but we had everybody in the class write down their biggest fear on a piece of paper related to entrepreneurship, fold it up, put it in a big bucket, and then we mixed it up and passed this bucket around. And you know, you could have read your own fear for sure by accident, but everybody else read everybody else's fear anonymously. And they were fears of failure, the feels, how do I overcome my lack of understanding of this space? I just want to make money, but I want to feel like a good person. People who had past medical issues, how do I overcome those? And sort of thinking through, you know, Babson has some incredible entrepreneurial, scholastic academic materials. But once you get somebody like me in there to break it I think that's what they were looking for. And I think it went really well. And I've had the opportunity to do it a few more times since then.
Awesome. So let's talk a little bit about Gravity now. What is Gravity and what led you to start it?
Yeah, so we're the first and only company focused on applying AI to social good. And that's primarily in the fundraising departments at hospitals, nonprofits, and universities, right? And they're really trying to solve two problems, right? So pulling from my experience at, you know, RelSci, we're trying to solve like one or two things, not a million things, right? So one is prioritization, and the other is having more relationships. And so organizations, once you get to a certain level in the nonprofit space, they've just got too many people to handle. And so you might be looking at a typical school, so Babson's got, you know, 20, 30,000 alumni, let alone parents, let alone people that are connected to the school in other ways. But you can really only talk to one person at a time. So trying to figure out from the slew of data we're put at or thrown all the time, from existing priorities at organizations, fundraisers usually don't stick around at a job for that long. The average tenure of a fundraiser is about 12 to 18 months. So you have this constant attrition and turnover in this industry. It's like, wow, AI technology is going to help solve this problem. So we figure out, you know, Vi, is it you or is it me that a fundraiser should talk to? And let's pick on you, right? Once they find out that it's you to talk to, the hard part starts. If it's a conversation that is the first one ever, that's much different than if you're a board member at Babson. That's much different if everybody knows that you did this podcast, right? So there's like some information around you. And so we handle sort of all of those experiences. So a lot of what we did from the earliest days is actually my co-founder was a fundraiser at Babson. That's how we met. We were both talking to, you know, Babson has so many awesome entrepreneurs that have been successful. One of them came in to do a speech, and it just so happened at the end of the day, I wanted to learn from this guy, and Adam, my co-founder, wanted to just continue establishing a relationship. That guy left to do his thing, and Adam and I started a conversation, and the story writes itself from there. But the really cool thing is we're really yin-yang, like the, you know, his fundraising understanding, and he was actually a former Olympic coach too, that team building, fundraising understanding, how to do empathetic sort of, he's great at cocktail parties, which I am not. If this is engaging, I have you fooled. I'm a tech guy at heart, right? And then my ability to pull that technology to handle the machine learning to solve a real world problem, you put those two things together and that's what we did. And it's been a great bet from day one and continues to be just honestly a defining, awesome moment in my career.
That's great. And I'm glad you brought up Adam. You know, one of my questions was that which side of the business do each of you focus on and why did you structure it that way? But I think that just clears that all up. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your competition. So do you have any competition in this space? And what really is your value proposition to the clients?
Yeah, so twofold. I am one of those people that, and as a professor, I said this to literally every one of my students, you should talk about your idea to as many people as possible. And competition's amazing, right? Especially if you're David and Goliath and going up against the incumbent, right? That big company can either spend the marketing dollars, mess up in a bunch of ways, and then clear a path for you. Or if they don't do any of that, you know they're not going to necessarily change their entire business around to come and attack you. That's why everybody always gets worried when, oh, Google is about to launch something that's competitive to me. Google's core business model is advertising, right? So by definition, as long as you're not doing advertising, in which case they buy a bunch of advertising companies, you're okay. You have space in this world to exist and execute, right? So that's my like methodology. That's what I truly believe that. One of the problems with Gravity is that we don't actually have that much competition, right? So I can't practice what I preach as often as I'd like with my own company. There's not a ton of startups in this space for a whole host of market dynamic reasons. Investors have been burned before in the nonprofit technology space, just companies that didn't scale fast enough to give them the requisite exit for the risk capital they were putting in. And there's, you know, the nonprofit industry is a little slower than others to sort of adopt new ways to do things. So you have this behavioral change, inertia, all this kind of stuff, right? So there's competitive kind of companies, but we always try to sort of compete against ourselves and be better than yesterday. So in the absence of competition, there's always, you being better than you were yesterday. And the core value proposition for us is pretty easy. And it's so amazing during the pandemic. We can turn a team of 10 fundraisers into the output of a team of 50 or more for 1/20th of the cost, right? So rather than go find these people that don't exist out there, a lot of my clients are laying off their staff without actually lowering their revenue targets. So you have to look through the mirror and be like, well, what are you going to do? Because you're not going to hire more people, but your top line number is not changing, right? And so expanding your existing people is the real value prop for us. And that's workforce expansion is what we talk about. And that's, we came on that realization maybe halfway through our gravity journey. And it's been an awesome value prop that we get behind and our clients get behind every single day.
That's great. And just going back to what you mentioned earlier, you mentioned the nonprofit industry is slightly slower growing, right? I think it would be interesting to also know if there were times when no one believed in the idea that you had.
Yeah, always. Like a whole bunch of people did not believe in us. We're that kind of broken set of entrepreneurs that once we saw a glimmer of hope, to take that even back further, we started this because of problems Adam was having doing his job with the existing tools. So as soon as we started thinking through those things and we realized, okay, he had worked at 4 or 5 different nonprofits, they all had the same problem. So what about hospitals? So we started talking to hospital friends. Okay, so what about other nonprofits? And we found that while the words and the mission and everything is totally different across different nonprofits, the structure and process of fundraising and the challenges they were having were the same. And so we, regardless of the negativity or anything around that we were facing from the outside world, we knew we were on a good path. And there's two sort of things that are worth talking about. Part of that path led us to a gentleman named Christopher Mrable, who's the head of Launchpad Venture Group, an angel group here, which I'm lucky enough now post, our investment to be a part of, which is great. Highly recommend it to go to Launchpad over anybody else. And he once said, you guys aren't CEO, CTO, anything like that. You're S is in Sam, CSOs, because you're the chief synthesizing officers. And your job is to take all of this data in and all this advice and everything, and it's going to conflict and everything to make up your own decision. And that's an operating model we were very lucky to have someone expose to us early on, which has sort of defined the way we take criticism and all that kind of stuff. Additionally, actually, at one of our Launchpad events, there was someone who had a lot of experience in this space. And if you know anything about angel groups, you got 100 pre-COVID, 150 people in the room, one dissenting opinion, you could ruin 150 opinions, right? And so this one dissenting opinion came up when we were pitching, and it was brutal. It cut us to the core. But we, and Adam was there, I was on the sidelines, thankfully, he took this one for the team. And he said, hey, person, I would love to explore that further with you. I'm sure you have valid reasons, but let me try to change your mind. He went over to this person's house later that week, talked through the value proposition and all that kind of stuff. And this person ended up actually investing in our company and becoming a advocate for us. And so, yeah, so all that kind of stuff, like that ability to hear a no or to feel the full brunt of intense criticism and find a way to win. If that is not an entrepreneurial skill set you innately have, which Adam and I think do, it's one you should quickly cultivate in order to succeed.
Right. I think that's a great piece of advice. Just talking a little bit more about your journey, right? So I mentioned in the intro that you were able to raise $21 million recently. When and how did you realize that it was time to start raising capital?
Yeah, so good. It was funny. Everybody talks about hockey stick growth, where, you know, the chart of revenue just sort of slowly goes up and then goes up incredibly at a ridiculous exponential rate. Again, no one believed us when we said that's what we were going to do. We got about 3 years in. We were growing 3x per year every single year since inception, which tracked to hockey stick growth. And so we were vocal about that to some extent to the market. You know, so once you get to a certain perceived size, still early stage, but you'll get inbound interest from associates and sort of those like folks at, you know, VC firms, PE firms, whole bunch of different financial organizations. And they're just trying to sort you into buckets, right? They're asking revenue numbers, growth numbers, churn numbers, just whatever. A lot of people don't take those calls because they don't think it's worth it. We started taking those calls from the very beginning. We were urged to by our board. Don't waste your time. We're going for an hour, but 5 minutes just to get in their buckets. To say, okay, nonprofit tech growing quickly, cool, I'll follow up with you in 3 months. We established one of those relationships early with a company called K1 Investments, which is based out in LA, private equity firm, many billions of dollars. And we started talking to them about a year before we actually decided we were going to raise money. The points of raising money, we had 3x per year every single year, and we were like, okay, we're headed towards profitability. And this was August of last year, I guess, right? So 2019. Once we hit profitability, the number of options just exploded for us, right? So we had interest from everywhere. We had term sheets on the table. We were negotiating things that I didn't think you could possibly negotiate. You never really think you have power as an entrepreneur. Went into conversations with K1, and they were so in tune with what we wanted to do. They thought 10 steps ahead where the market was going. They were like, we got resources as you guys try to build enterprise value and grow. And so they were very, very natural, you know, after tough diligence, very, very natural investor. And I wouldn't have changed a single thing about that process. It's been great ever since too.
Well, that's really good to hear. And what kind of advice do you have for entrepreneurs that are looking to raise capital?
Yeah. So I touched on those, you know, building the relationships before you raise capital. Obviously at the big number stage, like we just did, that's just as true as, you know, one of our first checks was, you know, $5,000, right? So the relationship and that person is still involved in helping us think through different things. So they just check up on us, say, what's up, you know? Another one is a couple of things. So I'll try to be relatively brief, right? If you're trying to raise capital, and this one, every once in a while, I like to throw out something controversial. So this one, here's my one of maybe two controversial things, right? Now is a great time to raise capital because a whole bunch of financial organizations are sitting on a pile of money that they've been hesitant to deploy during the pandemic. And whether you think things are going to get better, which case they'll deploy it, or whether you think things will stay bad, in which case they have to deploy it anyway because they've raised it, you have this sort of eagerness to, you know, pay fair prices for deals rather than like nickel and dime entrepreneurs. And we've been seeing a lot of situations where there'll be like sort of the secondary concept where the founders, early employees, and early investors get money out while also being able to keep some money in the company. And I think, I'm not sure, you know, I'm not a professional investor by any means, so I don't know how long this sticks around for, but it's awesome to be able to take a little bit off and have what we like to call a second bite of the apple. That only works though, if like you have those big relationships, especially if you're pitching angel groups, you have to sort of seed the room with champions, people that are going to stand up for you. Even when that dissenter will stand up, there's always somebody there who just wants to be difficult, right? Or point out a problem or whatever. You need five other people in that room to say, hey, great point. Doesn't matter. These people are going to just rocket ship this company, right? And that leads to sort of this last point, which again, people hate to hear, but you should always be pitching, in my idea. The coffee shop person, pitch to them. The investor, pitch to them. Your parents, your friends, your loved ones, pitch to them. Always be pitching. Some of the worst fears entrepreneurs have is that they're not ready to talk about their idea or they think that person might steal it or whatever. It's the number of situations where something's gotten stolen just by you talking about it is incredibly low. And research also points to that, which is, you know, this is advice everybody should take to heart. ABP, I say, always be pitching.
Right. I agree. I 100% agree with the last point you made. So just shifting gears a little, I wanted to ask, has the recent pandemic affected your business in any kind of way? Or did you see any opportunities? Are there any opportunities that you were able to discover since the start of the pandemic for your business?
Yeah. So I already sort of mentioned that, you know, talent pool is shrinking and people were laid off, but the top line revenue numbers haven't changed. A lot of universities early on, like April, May, had to refund tuition and do all that kind of stuff. So top line revenue number didn't change and they were already operating at a loss, right? And so our value proposition has not changed. It's AI can fill that gap by helping your team just get bigger without actually getting bigger, you know? But what we've seen, which is interesting, is organizations all across the nonprofit spectrum are in need of that. So we've been working a lot lately, which, you know, I'm surprised, but it's probably not surprising. Organizations like food banks, we've signed a bunch of food banks to Gravity lately. Organizations where a lot of the stuff they were doing was outside or in group settings or whatever, like the National Parks Foundation is a client, right? And they don't know what to do, right? Or theater companies, arts and culture, they're closing their doors for this year. And so if they want to be around for 2021, they need something to bridge that gap, right? And so that AI sort of thing stayed the same. I've seen, you know, one more thing sort of externally, and then I would like to talk about our team and what's happened with there, because it's kind of interesting. We were able to, in March, really quickly pivot our language. So our flagship product is called First Draft, and it's a self-writing email. So basically, we tee fundraisers up with our suggested language. They can change it, and then they hit send. So we're not like a spamming company or something. We literally give fundraisers like a first draft, and then they can do whatever they want with it. All of a sudden, they shouldn't be asking for money anymore. They should just be asking people how they are. Is their area affected? How are your loved ones? And so like the ability to use natural language processing and AI to quickly pivot our language, we had this crisis management module that we gave away for free so that our clients could take advantage of this new way of operating, which was really nice. And then sort of the last quick point is that we are hard charging entrepreneurs. The hours are long, the work is grinding. You know, it's really tough to be in this sort of startup setting. The presence of Zoom, every single day now, 9:15 in the morning, we have an all hands meeting with all 30 people that are at the company right now. And oftentimes there's spouses that walk through. There's kids in, you know, little harnesses on the front of our VP of sales, right? We show and tell our gardens. We have virtual happy hours. We do all this kind of stuff. It allowed us, and I didn't know this was missing before the pandemic, to be honest. It allowed us to understand from my perspective as, you know, a leader, my employees and what they go through outside of work with, you know, within boundaries of respect, but also each other, to lean on each other and to see that kind of whole person has been fascinating. We're lucky we raised that. Some of those early rounds were mostly from angel investors, and we were going to use it as a source of leads. Those angel investors, wealthy folks who are on the board of nonprofits or donate, right? So lead generation. Now they're coming and they're joining our all hands. We have people that are life coaches, sales experts, all kinds of different folks that are just being able to jump in and say, hey, this is what I saw the last, you know, in the recession. This is what I saw in the early 2000s. We had some really older folks who, this is what I saw even earlier than that. And so being able to sort of share that knowledge, the pandemic is awful, but I'm happy we've found a way to improve as a result of it.
That totally makes sense. Thank you so much for that, Rich. And I think with this, we've come to the end of our episode. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been great. I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot from your story. So appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Babs and Built. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please rate and review us, since that really helps others discover the podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Babson eShip and on Facebook at Babson Entrepreneurs. We're grateful to the Babson College student and alumni founders who participate in this podcast. These are their stories. Join us again for more Babson Builds.